nihilism, disgust with the individual and human society, combined with the desire for the eradication of existence, is one logical, evil consequence of heightened self-consciousness. It is not, however, the only consequence, and may not even be the most subtle. Far more efficient, far more hidden from the perpetrator himself and from his closest observers, is heightened identification with tradition and custom. This is envelopment in the guise of patriotism to facilitate the turning of state power toward destruction. Nietzsche described such loyalty in the following manner. Definition of morality. Morality, the idiosyncrasy of decadence, with the ulterior motive of revenging oneself against life. Successfully. I attach value to this definition. This description of initial motivated decision and consequent dissolution seems to me to characterize the processes and bifurcated final state of moral and therefore psychological degeneration more accurately and potently than any purely scientific theory of psychopathology generated to date. Of course, we are at present unable to take our rationally reduced selves seriously enough to presume a relationship between evil as a cosmic force and our petty transgressions and self-betrayals. We believe that in reducing the scope and importance of our errors, we are properly humble. In truth, we are merely unwilling to bear the weight of our true responsibility. The adversary in action, voluntary degradation of the map of meaning. Who alone has reason to lie himself out of actuality? He who suffers from it. Friedrich Nietzsche. Tragic encounter with the forces of the unknown is inevitable in the course of normal development, given continued expansion of conscious awareness. Even socialized identification with the cultural canon cannot provide final protection. Unshielded personal contact with tragedy is inextricably linked with emergence of self-consciousness, which has as its mythic consequence, its virtual equivalent, heightened awareness of human limitation. This awareness is manifested in shame and has been expressed mythologically as shame of nakedness, which is knowledge of essential vulnerability and weakness before the world. The intrinsic nature of human experience ensures that potent motivation for deceitful adaptation is always present. It is the encounter with what is truly horrible and terrifying, after all, that inspires fear and engenders avoidance. The human tendency to flee into false havens of security can therefore be viewed with sympathy and understanding. Maturation is a frightening process. Transformation from the paradisal matriarchal world of childhood to the fallen masculine social world is fraught with peril. The same might be said about the dangers of post-apprenticeship individuality. It is not easy to become an adolescent after being a child. It might be said that this transition is in itself a heroic act. It therefore happens upon occasion that those who have abandoned heroism as a style of adaptation do not take even this first step. The relative advantages that accompany increased freedom may seem frightening and of dubious value, given the comparative responsibility and lack of security that are part and parcel of maturity. As maturation takes place, the environment transforms. As the developing individual masters his powers, his behavioral capacity expands. He can do more things and, in consequence, experience more things. The ability to bring heretofore unknown and therefore frightening phenomena into being constantly increases, and the boundaries of the experiential domain of the individual eventually extend beyond the area shielded by the parents. The capability to endlessly further apprehension is central to the adaptive capacity of the individual. This capability, however, comes at an immense price, which is knowledge of finitude and death. potent motivation therefore exists to resist such development when it duly emerges, to fight desperately for maintenance of childhood ignorance or to hide in the commands of others. Individuality, which is the ability to establish a realm of experience that is unique to the self, the capacity for the creation of purely subjective experience, also means acceptance of vulnerability and mortality. The creative capacity is divine logos, which in the course of its development necessitates recognition of the inevitability of failure and death. That is, in part, the meaning of the symbol of the Christian crucifixion, which paradoxically melds mortality with divinity, which portrays the mortal God, infinitely creative, responsible, and vulnerable. Individual existence means limited existence, limited in space and time. The existence of the limits makes experience possible. The fact of them makes experience unbearable. We have been granted the capacity for constant transcendence as an antidote, but frequently reject that capacity because using it means voluntarily exposing ourselves to the unknown. We run away because we are afraid of the unknown at bottom. Such fear also makes us cling to our protective social identities, which shield us from what we do not understand. So, while running away, we necessarily become slave to convention and habit and deny the troublesome best within ourselves. Why run away? It is fear. Fear of the unknown and its twin, fear of rejection by the protective social world, which leads to pathological subjugation of unique individual personality, to rejection of the totality of personal being, which, when manifested, has truly redemptive capability. The Great Father hates innovation and will kill to prevent it. The Great Mother, source of all new knowledge, has a face that paralyzes when encountered. How can we not run away when confronted by such powers? But running away means that everything worthwhile ages, then dies. When a child is born, he is protected from the vagaries of existence by the benevolence of circumstance through maternal presence. The infant is prepared a priori, instinctively, to respond to such protection and to form a relationship, a bond with the mother. The helpless baby is at the mother's mercy, but is sheltered as well from the terrible world. Culture intercedes in the form of proscriptions on behavior when mortality nonetheless threatens, but adherence to such requirements means increased responsibility, separation from the good mother, and sacrifice of the primary dependent relationship. Culture molds the maturing personality, offering knowledge, but at the same time limitation, as the social world mangles individuality, interest, and meaning. Spirit is offered up to the group to maintain the group's benevolent nature, ensuring its continued protection and its grant of knowledge derived from history. It is necessary to identify with the group in the course of normal development. That identification fosters maturity and separation from blind maternal solicitude. But ultimately, the group is tyrannical and demands obedience at the cost of unique being. This is not to say naively that the group is intrinsically evil, that the root of human suffering is buried in the ground of the social world. Society is more purely expansion of power, which may be directed according to individual choice. The past contains within it the behavioral wisdom of generations established in pain and fear, and offers the possibility of immense extension of individual power and ability. Culture and civilization offers each individual the opportunity to stand on the shoulders of giants. Adoption of group identity should constitute apprenticeship, not capitulation. Should constitute a developmental stage in disciplined maturation, requiring temporary subjugation and immolation of immature individuality, prior to its later reemergence in controllable form under voluntary direction. Group membership, social being, represents a necessary advance over childish dependence, but the spirit of the group requires its pound of flesh. Absolute identification with the group means rejection of individual difference, means rejection of deviation, even weakness from the group viewpoint, means repression of individuality, sacrifice of the mythic fool, means abandonment of the simple and insufficient younger brother. The group, of course, merely feels that it is doing its duty by insisting upon such sacrifice. It believes, with sufficient justification, that it is merely protecting its structure. However, the group is not capable of making final judgments regarding what is necessary, what is good and what is evil, because it is incomplete by its very nature. It is a static structure composed of the past. Individual difference, even weakness, anathema to the absolutist, is strength from a more inclusive viewpoint. Is that force capable of transcending inevitable group limitation and extending the reach of all? Absolutists, rejecting the necessity of all change, necessarily deny to themselves and others even their own strength, because true heroism, regardless of its source, has the capacity to upset the status quo. Through such denial, the absolutist hopes to find protection from his individual vulnerability. In truth, however, he has suppressed and pathologized the sole element within himself that could actually provide such protection. He has undermined his ability to utilize the sole process capable of actually providing security and freedom. As Nietzsche comments, a traveler who had seen many countries and peoples and several continents was asked what human traits he had found everywhere. And he answered, "Men are inclined to laziness." Some will feel that he might have said with greater justice, "They are all timorous. They hide behind customs and opinions." At bottom, every human being knows very well that he is in this world just once as something unique, and that no accident, however strange, will throw together a second time into a unity such a curious and diffuse plurality. He knows it, but hides it like a bad conscience. Why? From fear of his neighbor who insists on convention and veils himself with it. But what is it that compels the individual human being to fear his neighbor, to think and act herd fashion, and not to be glad of himself? A sense of shame, perhaps, in a few rare cases. In the vast majority, it is the desire for comfort, inertia. In short, that inclination to laziness of which the traveler spoke. He is right. Men are even lazier than they are timorous. And what they fear most is the troubles with which any unconditional honesty and nudity would burden them. Only artists hate this slovenly life in borrowed manners and loosely fitting opinions and unveil the secret, everybody's bad conscience, the principle that every human being is a unique wonder. They dare to show us the human being as he is, down to the last muscle, himself and himself alone. Even more, that in this rigorous consistency of his uniqueness, he is beautiful and worth contemplating, as novel and incredible as every work of nature, and by no means dull. When a great thinker despises men, it is their laziness that he despises, for it is on account of this that they have the appearance of factory products, and seem indifferent and unworthy of companionship or instruction. The human being who does not wish to belong to the mass must merely cease being comfortable with himself. Let him follow his conscience, which shouts at him, "Be yourself." What you are at present doing, opining, and desiring, that is not really you. Denial of unique individuality turns the wise traditions of the past into the blind ruts of the present. Application of the letter of the law when the spirit of the law is necessary makes a mockery of culture. Following in the footsteps of others seems safe and requires no thought, but it is useless to follow a well-trodden trail when the terrain itself has changed. The individual who fails to modify his habits and presumptions as a consequence of change is deluding himself, is denying the world, is trying to replace reality itself with his own feeble wish. By pretending things are other than they are, he undermines his own stability, destabilizes his future, and transforms the past from shelter to prison. The individual embodiment of collective past wisdom is turned into the personification of inflexible stupidity by means of the lie. The lie is straightforward voluntary rejection of what is currently known to be true. Nobody knows what is finally true by definition, but honest people make the best possible use of their experience. The moral theories of the truthful, however incomplete from some hypothetical transcendent perspective, account for what they have seen and for who they are, insofar as that has been determined in the course of diligent effort. It is not necessary to define truth, to have seen and heard everything. That would make truth itself something impossible. It is necessary only to have represented and adapted to what has been seen and heard, to have represented and adapted to those phenomena characterizing the natural and social worlds as encountered and the self as manifested. This is to say, merely, that the truth of children and adults differs because their experience, their reality, differs. The truthful child does not think like an adult. He thinks like a child with his eyes open. The adult, however, who still uses the morality of the child, despite his adult capacities, he is lying, and he knows it. The lie is willful adherence to a previously functional schema of action and interpretation, a moral paradigm, despite new experience that cannot be comprehended in terms of that schema, despite new desire which cannot find fulfillment within that framework. The lie is willful rejection of information apprehended as anomalous on terms defined and valued by the individual doing the rejecting. That is to say, the liar chooses his own game, sets his own rules, and then cheats. This cheating is failure to grow, to mature. It is rejection of the process of consciousness itself. The lie is therefore not so much a sin of commission in most cases as a sin of omission, although it may take the former condition as well. The lie is a matter of voluntary failure to explore and to update. The appearance of an anomalous occurrence in the ongoing stream of experience indicates only that the present goal-directed schema within which behavior is being undertaken and evaluated is characterized by the presence of a flaw. The place of the flaw, the reasons for its existence, the meaning of the flaw, its potential for altering interpretation and behavior, all that is hypothetical at the first stage of anomaly emergence and analysis. The unknown has to be mined for precise significance before it can be said to have been experienced, let alone comprehended, has to be transformed laboriously from pure affect into revision of presumption and action, into psyche or personality. Not doing is therefore the simplest and most common lie. The individual can just not act, not investigate, and the pitfalls of error will remain unmanifest, at least temporarily. This rejection of the process of creative exploration means lack of effortful update of procedural and declarative memory, adaptation to the present as if it still were the past, refusal to think. The rectification of error is, after all, not inevitable. It is neither effortless nor automatic. Mediation of order and chaos requires courage and work. Adoption of identity with the heroes of the past is necessary, but rife with pathological potential. It becomes certain corruption when the identified individual is a liar who has voluntarily rendered himself incapable of personal heroism. Adoption of group identity and position means access to the power embodied in the past, means access to the collective strength and technical ability of the culture. This power is terribly dangerous in cowardly and deceitful hands. The liar cannot see any value in weakness or deviance in himself or others, only the potential for chaos, and he cannot see any value in chaos or uncertainty. He has no sympathy or patience for or appreciation of his own weaknesses or his own strengths, and can therefore have none for the weakness or strength of others. The liar can only pretend to embody what is best of the past because he cannot support or tolerate the presence of necessary deviance in the present. This means that the liar is a tyrant because he cannot stand being a fool. The liar cannot tolerate anomaly because it provokes anxiety, and the liar does not believe that he can or should withstand anxiety. This means that he is motivated to first avoid and then to actively suppress any behavioral pattern or experience of world that does not fit comfortably into his culturally determined system of affect-regulating moral presuppositions. Avoidance means that anomalous experience is kept unconscious, so to speak, which means incompletely realized. The implications of the dangerous thought remain unconsidered. The presence of the threatening fantasy remains unadmitted. The existence of the unacceptable personal action remains unrecognized. Active suppression does not mean intrapsychic repression in the classic sense, but aggressive action undertaken in the world to forcibly eliminate evidence of error. This may mean treachery, spiritual cruelty, or the outright application of power. May mean application of whatever maneuver is presumed necessary to destroy all indication of insufficiency. The bearer of bad news therefore inevitably suffers at the hand of the deceitful individual who would rather kill the source of potential wisdom than benefit from its message. The lie is easy and rewarding as it allows for the avoidance of anxiety, at least in the short term. In the long run, however, the lie has terrible consequences. The avoidance or suppression of novel or unexpected experience, which is the abstract equivalent of running away, transforms it perforce into determinate threat, is the categorical equivalent of labeling as threat. The domain of unprocessed novelty, defined prima facie by inaction and avoidance as threat too intolerable to face, expands inevitably with time when the past is held as absolute. More and more experience is therefore rendered intolerable, inexplicable, and chaotic as the cumulative effects of using the lie as a mode of adaptation inexorably manifest themselves. The lie transforms culture into tyranny, change into danger, while sickening and restricting the development and flexibility of adaptive ability itself. Reliance on the lie ensures, as fear grows, heightened, pathologized identification with the past, manifested as fascism, personal and political intolerance, or decadent degeneration, manifested as nihilism, personal and social deterioration. Identification with the spirit of denial eventually makes life unbearable as everything new, and therefore everything defining hope, comes to be axiomatically regarded as punishment and threat. Makes life unbearable as the realm of acceptable action shrinks inexorably. the attendant and unavoidable suffering experienced generates the desire for and motivates actions predicated on the attainment of the end of all experience as compensation and revenge for sterility, absence of meaning, anxiety, hatred, and pain. As in this story cited by Ellen Edwardes and R.E.L. Masters. The Marabout, North African hermit or holy man, draws a large circle in the dirt, which represents the world. He places a scorpion, symbolic of man, inside the circle. The scorpion, believing it has achieved freedom, starts to run around the circle, but never attempts to go outside. After the scorpion has raced several times around the inside edge of the circle, the marabout lowers his stick and divides the circle in half. The scorpion stops for a few seconds, then begins to run faster and faster, apparently looking for a way out, but never finding it. Strangely enough, the scorpion does not dare to cross over the line. After a few minutes, the marabout divides the half circle. The scorpion becomes frantic. Soon, the marabout makes a space no bigger than the scorpion's body. This is the moment of truth. The scorpion, dazed and bewildered, finds itself unable to move one way or another. Raising its venomous tail, the scorpion turns rapidly, round and round, in a veritable frenzy. Whirling, whirling, whirling until all of its spirit and energy are spent. In utter hopelessness, the scorpion stops, lowers the poisonous point of its tail, and stings itself to death. Its torment is ended. The individual who lives by the lie continually shrinks his domain of competence, his explored and familiar territory. Eventually, in consequence, he has nowhere left to turn, except to himself. But his own personality has, in the meantime, become shrunken and inept as a consequence of underdevelopment, as a consequence of repeated failure to participate in the process that turns pre-cosmogonic matter into spirit and world. Nothing remains but weakness, resentment, hatred, and fear. Thus, the chaos that is rejected out of desire for too much security attains its inevitable victory. The vicious circle created by the liar spirals down inevitably to the underworld. This process is schematically represented in Figure 58, the vicious circle of the adversary. The patriarchal system, the known, is the concrete consequence of past adaptation, the hierarchically integrated and represented residue of the heroic past. Such adaptation is necessarily incomplete in that the full scope of natural phenomena always exceeds the capacity for interpretation. Absolutist application of the past, motivated by fear of the unknown, transforms the past perforce into tyranny, which does not tolerate inevitable individual or deviant experience. This process of absolute ancestral deification is the consequence of security seeking, made necessary by the abandonment of individual heroism as a potential mode of adaptation. Such abandonment occurs as a consequence of premature and arrogant self-definition. Definition that makes of evident human vulnerability final and sufficient evidence for the unbearable cruelty of God and the uselessness of man. The constant search for security, rather than the embodiment of freedom, is wish for rule by law's letter, rather than law's spirit. The resultant forcible suppression of deviance is based upon desire to support the pretense that the unknown does not exist. This suppression has as its consequence the elimination of creative transformation from the individual and social spheres. The individual who denies his identification with the heroic will come to identify with and serve the tyrannical force of the past and to suffer the consequences. This principle is aptly illustrated by the mythic story of Judas. Judas sacrifices Christ, the hero, to the authorities of tradition for all the best reasons and is then driven to destroy himself in despair. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood." And they said, "What is that to us? See thou to that." And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. Matthew 27:3-5. Sacrifice of the hero to the great and terrible father means abandonment of identification with the process that makes cosmos out of chaos. Rejection of the process whereby the endlessly negative and terrifying is transformed into the acceptable and beneficial means, by definition, the end of all hope. Wherefore I say unto you, all manner of sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men, but the blasphemy against the Holy Ghost shall not be forgiven unto men. And whosoever speaketh a word against the Son of Man, it shall be forgiven him. But whosoever speaketh against the Holy Ghost, it shall not be forgiven him, neither in this world, neither in the world to come. Matthew 12:31-32. The individual lies to convince himself and others that he embodies the greatness of the past. He pretends to be upright and courageous instead of acting morally and bravely. Truly courageous actions might turn the group against him, and it is only identity with that group that keeps his head above water. The lie means denial of self, means the abandonment of mythic identity with God, means certain involuntary revolutionary collapse in time. The lie means conscious refusal to modify and reconfigure historically predicated behavior and belief to incorporate novelty and alleviate threat. Endless failure to voluntarily update means the generation of a morass around the individual where the water of life once existed. What could be life-giving liquid becomes a deadly swamp, composed of past errors, unresolved traumas, and current difficulties. This is the domain characterized by Freud as the unconscious into which repressed memories are cast. But unprocessed information is not precisely memory. That which has not yet been explored is not yet memorable, not yet even real. The consequence of untaken action is more accurately potential from which spirit and world could be constructed, much of it implicit in the world as it currently exists, instead of stored in memory. Implicit, that is, in the form of unencountered but latent trouble, in the form of the unanswered letter, the unpaid debt, or the unresolved dispute. This self-generated swamp grows increasingly impenetrable as time passes, becomes increasingly uninhabitable as the consequences of long-term avoidance propagate, as the monsters of the bog sprout new and hungry heads. This accumulation of pre-cosmogonic potential is tantamount to reanimation of the dragon of chaos, is precisely equivalent to the reawakening of Tiamat, who eternally sleeps under the secure and familiar world. The more restricted, fear-bound, faithless, and repressive the particular mode of adaptation, that is, the more extreme the lie, the more horrendous, dangerous, intolerable, and powerful the associated dragon. It is in this manner that attitude comes to define the world. Every attempt to wish any aspect of experience out of existence transforms it into an enemy. Every facet of being hidden from the light leads a corrupt and sun-starved existence underground. experience. Absolute reality itself, in the final analysis, cannot be denied without consequence. Reality cannot be fantasized out of existence. The enforcement of a wish merely ensures that the information contained in the denied experience can neither be removed from the domain of threat nor utilized for adaptive purposes. It is possible that we are, in fact, adapted to the world, that we are adapted to the world as it actually exists, rather than to the world as we wish it might be. It is possible that our experience contains information precisely sufficient to ensure our happy survival. This means that every task left undone, every emergent territory left unexplored, comprises latent information from which competent personality could yet be extracted. If experience is valid as source of world and spirit, then those elements of experience that have been avoided or suppressed or devalued may yet contain within them what is absolutely essential to continued successful existence. Voluntary movement toward the good would therefore mean reintegration of cast-off material, voluntary incorporation of that which appears at present indigestible. The alternative to this voluntary pursuit of the inedible is eventual psychological catastrophe at the social or individual level, engendered through involuntary contact with the hostile forces of rejected being. From the mythological perspective, this psychological catastrophe is accidental reunion with the terrible mother on territory of her choosing. This Oedipal incest culminates in certain suffering on the part of the unwilling hero, culminates in suicide, dismemberment, castration, ends in the final sacrifice of masculine consciousness and in the victory of the underworld. The identity of the individual with his culture protects him from the terrible unknown and allows him to function as an acceptable member of society. This slavish function strengthens the group. But the group states that certain ways of thinking and acting are all that are acceptable, and these particular ways do not exhaust the unknown and necessary capabilities of the human being. The rigid, grinning social mask is the individual's pretense that he is the same person as everyone else, that is, the same dead person. That he is not a natural disaster, not a stranger, not strange. That he is not deviant, weak, cowardly, inferior, and vengeful. The true individual, however, the honest fool, stands outside the protective enclave of acceptance, unredeemed. The personification of weakness, inferiority, vengefulness, cowardice, difference. He cannot make the cut. And because he cannot make the cut, he is the target of the tyranny of the group and of his own judgment, insofar as he is that group. But man as a fool, weak, ignorant, and vulnerable, is what the group is not. A true individual, truly existing, truly experiencing, truly suffering, if it could only be admitted. Consciousness of intrinsic personal limitation and apprehension of its consequences brings clear definition of the nature of subjective experience when allowed to surface, and fosters attempts to adapt to that experience. It is for this reason that only the unredeemed, the outcast, the sick, the blind, and the lame can be saved. Apprehension of the true nature of subjective experience, of individual reality outside the delusionary constraints of the group, is of sufficient power to demoralize absolutely. The eternal consequence of self-consciousness is therefore the expulsion from Eden in its maternal and patriarchal forms. But such a fall is a step on the way to the true paradise, is a step toward adoption of identity with the hero, who is not protected from the vagaries of existence, but who can actively transform the terrible unknown into the sustenant and productive world. acceptance, at least recognition, of the mortal limitation characterizing human experience therefore constitutes the precondition for proper adaptation. The lie, which denies individual experience, is denial of the fool, but the fool is the truth. Acceptance of mortal weakness is the paradoxical humility that serves as precondition for true heroism. The heroic attitude is predicated on the belief that something new and valuable still exists to be encountered and assimilated, regardless of the power and stability of the current position. This belief is further based upon faith in human potential, upon faith that the individual spirit will respond to challenge and flourish. Such belief must be posited voluntarily, freely, prior to participation in any heroic endeavor. This is the necessary leap that makes courageous and creative action possible, that makes religion something real. Humility means, therefore, I am not yet what I could be. This is an adage both cautious and hopeful. The adversarial position, deceit, is predicated on the belief that the knowledge of the present comprises all necessary knowledge, is predicated on the belief that the unknown has finally been conquered. This belief is equivalent to denial of vulnerability, equivalent to the adoption of omniscience. What I do is all there is to do. What I know is all there is to know. Inextricably associated with the adoption of such a stance is denial, implicit or explicit, of the existence, the possibility, and the necessity of the heroic, as everything worthwhile has already been done, as all problems have been solved, as paradise has already been spread before us. This is a terrible position. As the axiom of faith, we are redeemed, makes human suffering itself, which can never be eradicated as a consequence of ideological identification, something heretical, something that can exist only as an insult to the guardians of traditional order. The authoritarian is thereby necessarily stripped of his empathy, even for himself. In the perfect world presently extant, nothing imperfect may be allowed to exist. So the adversary backs himself into a position where he cannot admit even to his own misery, let alone the misery of others. A more hopeless position cannot possibly be imagined. Acceptance of insufficiency paradoxically catalyzes identification with the hero and opens up the possibility of participation in the process of creation and renewal. Rejection of insufficiency produces, by contrast, identification with the adversary, whose eternal dwelling place is hell. This hell is something whose nature can be rendered explicitly comprehensible, despite its mythological character, is something that has familiar and defined features, is something that can be understood, first and foremost, as a consequence of the imbalance of the constituent elements of reality. Adoption of the deceitful or adversarial mode of adaptation produces an accelerated search for security and increased likelihood of aggression in those cases where identification with the cultural canon is deemed possible, or degeneration of personality and decadent breakdown where the costs of cultural identity are regarded as too high, where no such identity is waiting to offer protection, or where even fascistic behavior appears as something too positive to manifest in the all-too-unbearable world. Denial of the heroic promotes fascism, absolute identification with the cultural canon. Everything that is known within a particular historically determined framework predicated upon mythologically expressed assumptions. Denial or avoidance of the unknown therefore concomitantly necessitates deification of a particular previously established viewpoint. The way that things are under such circumstances must be the way they forever remain. Questioning the wisdom of the past necessarily exposes the anxiety-provoking unknown once again to view. This exposure of the unknown can be regarded as beneficial under those circumstances where positive adaptation to the unknown is viewed as possible, but only as destructive where lack of faith in the heroic rules. All that lives, however, grows. When conservatism destroys the capacity for individual creativity, when it becomes tyranny, then it works against life, not for it. The spirit within has withdrawn from the group afraid to develop. An absolutely conservative society cannot survive because the future transcends the limitations of the past, and the absolute conservative wants to limit what could be to what has already been. If history was complete and perfect, if the individual had fully exploited his highest potential, then the human race would be run. For all would be explored, all known, all accomplished. But this pinnacle of attainment has not yet been reached, and perhaps never will be. Those who pretend the contrary rapidly come to actively oppose the very process that delivers what they claim to have already obtained. Denial of the heroic promotes decadence equally. Absolute rejection of the order of tradition. Absolute rejection of order itself. This pattern of apprehension and behavior seems far removed from that of the fascist, but the decadent is just as arrogant as his evidently more rigid peer. He has merely identified himself absolutely with no thing rather than with one thing. He is rigidly convinced of the belief that nothing matters, convinced that nothing is of value, despite the opinions of clearly deluded, weak, and despicable others, convinced that nothing is worth the effort. The decadent functions in this manner like an anti-Midas. Everything he touches turns to ashes. Under normal circumstances, the individual who reaches adolescence identifies with the tribe, with the collective, historically determined structure designed to deal with threat. The normal individual solves his problem of adaptation to the unknown by joining a group. A group, by definition, is composed of those who have adopted a central structure of value and who therefore behave in the presence of other group members identically, and, if not identically, at least predictably. The fascist adapts to the group with a vengeance. He builds stronger and stronger walls around himself and those who are like him in an ever more futile attempt to keep the threatening unknown at bay. He does this because his worldview is incomplete. He does not believe in the heroic aspect of the individual, does not see the negative aspect of the social world, and cannot visualize the beneficial aspect of chaos. He is frightened enough to develop the discipline of a slave so that he can maintain his protected position in the group, but he is not frightened enough to transcend his slavish condition. He therefore remains twisted and bent. The decadent, by contrast, sees nothing but the tyranny of the state. Since the adversarial aspect of the individual remains conveniently hidden from his view, he cannot perceive that his rebellion is nothing but avoidance of discipline. He views chaos as a beneficial home, seeing the source of human evil in social regulation, because he cannot imagine the terrible mother as soul-devouring force. So, he abandons his father in the belly of the beast, unredeemed, and has no tools to rely on when he finally faces a true challenge. The decadent looks to subvert the process of maturation, looks for a way out of group affiliation. Group membership requires adoption of at least adolescent responsibility, and this burden may seem too much to bear as a consequence of prolonged immaturity of outlook. The decadent therefore acts as if the paradigmatic structure of the group has been rendered insufficient as a consequence of environmental, cultural, or intellectual change, and refuses to be the fool who risks belief. The proper response to the illness of the father is, of course, the journey to the land of living water. The decadent makes his intellectual superiority to the superstitions of the past an article of faith instead, and shirks his responsibility. That is to say, it is the desire to shirk that responsibility and the heroic sacrifice it entails that constitutes motivation for belief in intellectual superiority. The suffering rebel stance that such adoption allows as a secondary consequence also serves admirably as mask for cowardice. The fascist and the decadent regard each other as opposites, as mortal enemies. They are in actuality two sides of the same bent coin, as expressed by R. Durnan. Today is Christmas Day, and I have just come home from Julie's. While I was there, it struck me, as I sat on their couch between the two girls, just how foolish and idiotic I have been in this, my only life. I hope you will have patience while I unburden myself on you, because I need desperately to confess my sins to someone, and I know that if I were sitting in a little cubicle talking to an unseen clergyman, I wouldn't do a proper job of it. You fit the definition of a religious man as someone who gives careful consideration to the demonic and irrational in humanity, so I think you will find my confession interesting. Imagine, if you can, a grown man who harbors in his heart the most vicious resentment for his fellow man, his neighbor, who is guilty of nothing more than embodying a superior consciousness of what it means to be a man. When I think of all the black, scathing thoughts I have directed at those who I could not look in the eye, it is almost unbearable. All of my lofty disdain for the common man who, so I thought, was guilty of the sin of unconsciousness, was, I now realize, founded on nothing more than jealousy and spite. I hated, I absolutely loathed anyone who had wrestled with their fear of leaving the maternal confines of a childish mentality and won their battle, only because I had not done so. I equated independence and success with egotism and selfishness, and it was my fondest hope, my highest ambition, to witness and participate in the destruction of everything that successful, independent people had built for themselves. This I considered a duty. In fact, there was a decidedly fanatical element in my urge to cleanse the world of what I perceived to be selfishness. Think what would have happened if I had been in a position to realize my fine feelings. The memory makes me fear that any moment the earth will crack open and swallow me up, because if there is any justice, it would. I, who had not the faintest inkling of a capacity for moral judgment, traipsing around, passing judgment on anyone who dared cross my path. It makes me wonder that I have even one friend in this world. But of course, I had friends before. Anyone with enough self-contempt that they could forgive me mine. It is fortunate for humanity that there are few saviors of the caliber of myself. Did you know that I used to identify with Christ? I considered myself entirely, immaculately free of aggression and every other form of antisocial feeling. But what about the hatred I have just now confessed, you ask? That didn't count. Those feelings were based on sound common sense, you see. After all, there are sons of bitches in the world, and one needs to be ready for them. Do I smell ozone? They say you get a tingling sensation just before the lightning bolt strikes. That is a very apt phrase, son of a bitch. There is a passage in Jung's Phenomenology of the Self which runs, "Often a mother appears beside him, who apparently shows not the slightest concern that her little son should become a man, but who, with tireless and self-immolating effort, neglects nothing that might hinder him from growing up and marrying. You now behold the secret conspiracy between mother and son, and how each helps the other to betray life. This insight would be useful for me as an excuse, being a perfectly accurate description of my situation, were it not for the fact that I am almost daily presented with a residual bit of undiluted evil in myself. For example, when I am faced with a frustrating situation, I do not ask myself what I am going to do about it. I ask myself who is responsible for it. And I am always ready to conclude that if the other person were to act properly, then the problem would not exist. What is evil about that, you ask? Obviously, if I am determined to overlook my own part in the failure to resolve my own frustrations, if I am determined to find a scapegoat for my problems, then I am just a stone's throw away from the mentality that was responsible for Hitler's final solution, or for the Spanish Inquisition, or for Lenin's cultural cleansing. What was it you told me when I complained about the flaws in capitalism, about the fact that so many people take advantage of the capitalist system? Something like, the fact that people go on consolidating their financial position ad nauseam is another problem. But it is no reason to conclude that there is anything virtuous in refusing to even try to consolidate one's position in the first place. But it is so much easier to crown one's cowardice and laziness with the accolade of virtue. Just ask Lenin's henchmen, who swaggered around the countryside, robbing every farmer who had managed any success whatever, and called themselves friends of the common people, and patted each other on the back for their moral uprightness. I wonder if I have changed so much that I would not join them when put to the test. The idea that morality stems from a lack of personal interests is thoroughly ingrained in my mind. Good people are those who don't want anything for themselves, is the way I think. But I never ask myself why such a person should put any effort into disciplining himself or take any pains to keep his motives clear in his own mind, because there is nothing of value to him in this world. In his essay, Relations Between the Ego and the Unconscious, Jung says that in an unconscious state, the individual is torn by the conflict of opposites, and that achieving consciousness involves resolving that conflict on a higher level. I understand that this particular state of adult unconsciousness is different from the original state of childlike unconsciousness in which there is no long-term conflict. Just last week, I was stuck in that dead end again. I was sitting and thinking about what course my life should be taking, and at every imagined scenario of a fulfilling or meaningful activity, I was met by a counterpoint coming from somewhere in my head, showing me how this or that aspect of my scenario was wrong because it would result in this or that problem, to the point where it was unacceptable to consider any career at all, because just by being alive, I would contribute to the destruction of the planet. And as badly as I wanted to refute this echo of wrong to my every imagined right as an irrational chimera, the fact is, so I told myself, that we see daily in the newspapers how the activities of humanity, which are also the activities of individual men and women, are causing incalculable harm. It is, of course, due to my being influenced by yourself that I do not remain stuck in that particular bog too long these days. If our industrialism is causing problems, I now answer myself, then I should hope that there are people out there working to solve those problems, or perhaps I should try to do something about them myself. But by sitting idly by, I do not solve a thing. Of course, what is most daunting, and also most snivelly, about being stuck in that bog is the fact that the rational mind wants to be absolutely sure about the successful outcome of its life plan. And obviously, there is another part of the mind that knows that such certainty is impossible. So one is then faced with the need to accept on faith that things will turn out for the better with some luck and perseverance. And, being a fine, upstanding, modern mouse with an enlightened, rational mind, I have no use for faith and other such religious-sounding claptrap and nonsense. Faith is obviously irrational, and I'll not have any irrationality influencing my behavior. Previously, my solution to this problem was to allow chance to make my career choices for me, letting my own interests